This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
Welcome one and all back to the Decibel Geek Podcast. I'm Chris Sinzak, your host. I'm with my co-host Aaron Camaro.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun tonight. We're going to talk early Megadeth and Metallica.
That's right, and we got the perfect guest in to talk about the early days of both of those bands. We've got Bill Hale on the line, and Bill is a rock photographer who has put out books on both bands, most recently the new book on Megadeth. Bill, how are you doing this evening?
I'm just fine, guys. How you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing great. Bill's calling us from the great state of Hawaii. You done any surfing lately, Bill?
No, not really. I try to get out, because of my schedule and stuff. I'm in my office, doing books and stuff like that. I get out once a week on Sunday to hang out at the beach. So,
gotcha. Can you imagine that out on the beach? You'd be like, whoa, look at that metalhead out there on that wave. Out there doing an air guitar solo while you're hanging 10.
Yeah, well, you never know who's going to hang out at the beach. Funny story really quick is because Dave Murray from Iron Maiden lives on Maui. Right?
Oh, yeah, right,
and so when they start the tour, they always pick him up. And what they do, when they start the tour and end the tour, they park the Air Force One at Honolulu Airport. And they take him to a hotel room for a couple of days. You bunch of all these English Armenian people running around town. It's kind of crazy.
Well, man, I just want to tell you off the bat, just to get it out of the way, your books kick ass, man. I love the pictures in them. I mean, it's just it's a picture in time to see, Megadeth and Metallica in their early stages, and it's just amazing. I love it.
Yeah, I definitely would have to agree. The new book, Megadeth, Another Time, A Different Place, how's the response been on that one so far?
It's been good. Megadeth's one of those bands, when magazines like Ripped and Cream Metal Specials came out, they got a lot of publicity of them, and then all those photographers, well, I don't want to mention names, but they like big backdrops and hairspray and stuff, so
right.
They've got caught up in that syndrome a little bit, and my book, straight from the hip, no fluff. I mean, I've been photographing Mustaine since Metallica in 82, right? Mm-hmm. So we had this rapport, and I kind of actually broke Dave into all this, because he hates photographers. He hates, still does, and he hates photographs, and I was just lucky enough we had a good rapport going where he'd let me, do what I do all the time and stuff. And so I had one response from an old friend of mine whose girlfriend said, there's no cute pictures of Dave. I'm going like, it's a heavy metal book, no cute pictures of Dave. But there's, some serious shots. And thanks to you. And the other thing is, most people kind of get it. Mm-hmm. Megadeth fans are very fickle, one way or the other, and they're very vocal about Megadeth. And so I had a couple of responses that they didn't like it or whatever, but if you get it and you understand what's happening in it, it's golden. It's really cool.
Yeah, that's the thing about it, too. It's not the Kip Winger book. We're not looking for the pretty pose, and your photographs, and it shows through your work that your stuff is really natural.
Yeah, that's what, I'm a big fan of rock photography since I was a kid. And I studied like Baron Woolman and Jim Marshall and all those photographers, and they didn't have all those glamorous stuff. It's really right to get to the point of the photograph and stuff. And back in the film days, right, when you're especially not a kid, you have too much money. So two rolls of film for a concert, you had to make sure you got every shot counted. So it's one of those things. It's kind of cool. Thanks.
An interesting thing happened where the first time you came in contact with Metallica for Metal Rendezvous magazine out of San Francisco, and what was...
That's a great name, by the way. The first time I heard that, Metal Rendezvous, I thought, this is the coolest dating service ever.
Yeah, I think we nicked it off that stupid Crocus album. It was in between, we came with a name, and also we found out Crocus had that same name, but we kept it anyway.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. Right, that's right. So you were at that for a while, so you got to photograph and hang out and spend time with some really cool bands.
Well, I was just fortunate, the magazine, my buddy John Chernansky and I were just very fortunate to be and at that place at that time, and it just like we... you know, grew kids in the 70s, right? We saw, you know, I already saw Juice Priest and Thin Lizzy and, you know, UFO and Nazareth, all those, you know, bass bands. And then it just happened to be at that time, you know, with Ron Quintana from Metal Mania and stuff. And then Brian Segel from, in L.A., we just all happened to be at that same place at the same time. And then here comes Lars from Tenmark out of the blue kind of thing, you know. And Lars met all the major players in the California scene, like, within a couple of weeks, which is he just had that gift, I guess. And he knew Quintana, he met, you know, hung out with him a little bit. He met my editor, Stranansky, and then we just, you know, and then you actually heard, like, right, Hit the Lights. And it's they'd go to McGovney's house, and Lars would call up, hey, listen to this, put the phone on the ground, and Lars would call it off and count it off, and we'd hear the songs before they got, you know, released or anything like that. That was kind of cool. And so, yeah, we've been with the band just before, you know, probably before Lars actually started it. So.
Wow, from the very before the very beginning, really.
Yeah.
I mean, but Lars had that. He just had that gift. I mean, he said he knew Slagle. He met Bob Nalbadian. He, you know, hung out in San Francisco and met Ron Quintana. He met us. He just had that gift, you know, and he still has that gift of finding those people to work with.
Now, I'm sure Metallica was very good to watch to begin with when they had the original lineup, but would you agree that it seems like they probably became more of a force when Cliff joined the group? Would you agree with that?
Exactly. And doing my first book, Metallica the Club Days, you had to go through and you scan all the negatives. You have to, like, think of a concept and just bring back those memories. And I remember I knew Cliff. I saw Cliff in Trauma. I knew Cliff for a while and stuff. And the minute they stepped on stage, it was like something together. But he did that bass solo, right?
Yeah.
And that was really cool. And then Lars jumped in and finished it off. And at that point, I knew that band was like the most dangerous band in the world. I would have put Metallica with Stain and Burton and put it against Black Sabbath from 72 or Deep Purple from like 71 or even Zeppelin. That they were that good. it was everybody in that club at the Stone, both shows, like, knew it. It was like, you know, the band got on, everybody shut the hell fuck up and just like watch this machine going on. So it was really cool.
That's awesome. And the stories about the band being called Alcoholica, did they really live up to that title back in those days?
We all drank, though. You know, we all kind of drank, you know, whatever you could afford. I think at first, no one had much money, so like Pepner Schnapps and Budweiser or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, but as, you know, Metallica starts going into Europe and stuff, and then, you know, then those vices take over even more. Yeah. And so, and you have nothing to, you know, like James had no parents kind of thing because he, you know, living on his own for a while. And it was just, you know, those things take over. And yeah, they were, but we all drank. It was one of those things.
Alcoholica. I'll always love that. I thought that was so cool. So what we're actually doing today, we're talking to Bill and we're hanging out. We're having a good time, but we're going to play some music too. And what we've done is we've kind of set it up where we're each going to pick songs. And today's show is about early Megadeth and early Metallica. And Chris, the shortest straw has been drawn for you, my friend. You get to go first. So you're going to be picking off of Kill 'Em All. What's your first choice of the night?
My first choice of the night is my favorite Metallica song of all time. And because it has a little bit of everything. It's got the thrash, it's got the speed, and it's got one killer guitar solo. So off of Kill 'Em All, the debut album, I'm going to go with Four Horsemen. We'll be right back.
Yeah, Four Horsemen, killer song. I love that one. Bill, you got any cool stories about the early days of Metallica? Is there anything that maybe something that you know that you don't think most Metallica fans realize? Something that you can break out for us?
Well, you know, now, you know, 30 years later, and then with the Big Four, and then Dave rejoining them a couple times, I think everybody, especially the last like 3 years, really understood how much Mustaine contributed to the early Metallica sound and the early Metallica isms or whatever. When I first saw them, James was so shy. I mean, he wouldn't introduce the songs, and Dave would have to go, you know, and introduce all the songs. And as the band progressed, and we saw James become a lead singer and stuff. Then he finally got into that, you know. But Dave had the attitude. Dave was the one flipping people off. Dave was saying the F bomb all the time. It was, you know, really Mustaine being that the
Metallica front man.
Mustaine, and then it was really kind of
So, I mean, for a guy who was there from the very, very beginning, it sounds to me like I may already know the answer to this question, but do you think that lineup with Dave Mustaine, out of all the years of Metallica, do you think that was their best lineup? I mean, you were there to see it. A lot of us can speculate, but you were there. What do you think?
On the onset, yeah, but when Hammett really got into his own, because Master Puppets is an amazing album.
Yeah.
And the band really, really gelled at that point. So the first part, yeah, it was Mustaine, but when Kurt really got to his, you know, learned how to get into the band, everybody started grooving, it was, you know, that lineup when they went to Master the Puppets, that was amazing, you know. when it first came out, even before, because, you know, we'd hear the demos and stuff, all the kids going to concerts would say, Master Puppets. It was like, you know, you got something good when, and all the fans start, you know, picking up on the lingo and stuff. So.
Yeah, hell yeah. Well, then, Unfortunately, it couldn't last, and Megadeth ended up splitting off and doing their own thing. That brings us to your pick, Bill. You're picking off of Killing's My Business, the Megadeth debut.
Yeah, it has to be Rattlehead. When I was doing the Megadeth book, I needed inspiration to get your mindset back in that time, and I must have played, you know, Rattlehead nonstop for, like, hours, just trying to find the feeling, trying to find all that girth and grit and all that stuff that came out with it.
What? Yeah, killer song, man. That's a rocking one right there. You guys are listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast. I'm Aaron Camaro, Chris Zinzak with me, joined by Bill Hale. This man is an amazing photographer who was there at the early days of Metallica and Megadeth, and that's what we're talking about today, spinning some tunes, letting Bill tell some stories. Bill, more insight to the early days of Metallica.
People have to understand the San Francisco scene was a big, for all of us, it was a gang, you know. It was like, you know, the band called Vicious Rumors, this band called Lost Rocket, there was Exodus, and we're all just like, you know, brothers in arms kind of thing. It was really kind of cool. And, you know, it was really big news. Like, so when Dave got kicked out, the Whispers and Kirk got in, that was kind of cool. It was good to see, you know, Hammett, you know, because he was a really good guitar player. Exodus was up and coming. But to see him on stage for the first time with Metallica, we all kind of felt, and it really, we knew back then, Metallica was a San Francisco band. You know, no more LA stuff for these guys. And so it was kind of cool.
You mentioned that, and we've interviewed a number of people from the LA scene in that era, and they always describe it with, you know, it was almost like a powder keg. You could feel the electricity. Was it a similar situation in San Francisco with all of the metal bands getting ready to blow up out of there?
Not really. It was the difference between LA and San Francisco. You move to LA to be a star, you're born in San Francisco. And it was that's when, you know, because you think all the bands before that, you know, the Grateful Dead, and then like Journey, and then like Y&T, all those bands from that area, and they all grew up there and stuff. So it's like, you know, and with all that rich history and culture, it's organic kind of thing. And so, you know, with Lost Rocket and Exodus and Testament and all those other bands, it was natural for these guys to take the guitars. And they had a club scene already because all the older people had the clubs. And then just the media was there, you know, so it was really natural for all this stuff to go on. And it was brothers and I. We were all, you know, at Christmas time, we'd go to certain clubs to make sure to see who's hanging out. And, you know, and you're hanging out to see who's on tour, what kind of stories we told and stuff. It was really kind of cool.
And now, Deep Thoughts with Phil Anselmo.
You take some Diet Coke and you mix it up with some NutraSweet and you take it to your friends who wear the Suicidal Tendencies t-shirts and you tell them, hey, you're suicidal, man. What are you? You want to kill yourself or something? And you say, no, man, you know something. People always come up to me and say, hey, man, you're suicidal. But I say, I'm lovely.
I suppose, I guess at that time, the biggest difference between L.A. and San Francisco is you got to figure in L.A. in the music scene, you got Quiet Riot, boom, they get signed. All of a sudden, they got big hit songs. Then you got Motley Crue, boom, they get signed. And they're a big, huge band going out on tour around the world. In the San Francisco scene, you had these great bands, but they were more grinding it out. You know, they weren't getting big hits and radio play. They were getting their fans the old-fashioned way of just playing kick-ass shows. And fortunately, Bill, you were there to see a lot of that early good stuff.
Yeah, and you're right, because Y&T was before all those bands, and Y&T, like, the only band I know that you can call a California band. They were, you know, they played in L.A., they played in San Francisco. Everybody was anybody, like, even, like, Motley Crue and Van Halen opened up for Y&T.
Yeah, Y&T is a good band.
They didn't get big until, you know, they conformed to the L.A. sound kind of thing, you know, the big hair and like that. And San Francisco people didn't like that whatsoever. I think in the end, who's still around, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, who's still one of the biggest bands? You know, Metallica's one of the biggest bands on the planet. You know, Megadeth's still grinding away. Exodus is still doing it. Testament has a new album coming out. And so the longevity of these bands is incredible. I mean, we're all almost 50 or almost 50, and it's just to do that still. I mean, I know Mustaine's 50, and he's been on tour for like 3 years now, nonstop just about. And, you know, he's gone through his pains and aches, but he's still doing it. He looks really good doing it. So,
you know, I've said it before, I'll say a million times, you know, good music is good music, and it stands the test of time. You know, all these years later, these bands are still in high demand. And it's because of the great music. And that's basically what it boils down to. When you're talking about great music, hey, guess what? It's my turn to pick a song. We're up to 1984, Ride the Lightning, Metallica. I'm going to have to agree with you, Bill, on this one. I'm going to go with Fight Fire with Fire.
Yeah.
awesome tune. I love that one. Bill, what do you think?
When that album came out, there's a magazine called Kerrang.
Yeah.
And they dedicated this. I mean, usually album reviews are like, you know, half a page or whatever. They dedicated two whole pages. And I think it was Malcolm Dome took every single song apart and just glorified it. It was like, wow, okay. And it was nice. Kind of cool to see everybody else grabbing on to this band called Metallica.
I want to go back to with the Metal Rendezvous. During that period of time, did the success or the breakout of Metallica and some of those bands, did that really propel Metal Rendezvous forward? Did it give you guys some good street cred at the time?
This is the dichotomy of the whole my whole universe kind of thing. we put Metallica in here and there, but we didn't do a full on story until like 85, and Lars hated us for it for a long time. But you know, when you're up and coming a metal band, you know, there's like, here comes Accept, you know, if from LA, yeah, here comes Wasp or whatever, and then here comes Exciter from Canada. You have all these bands coming in, and so you have to prioritize what's going to be on the cover, and you have to think 2-3 months ahead. Okay, here comes Loudness. I took the very first photographs of Loudness in the United States. They flew in to San Francisco, and I had a buddy at a record store. He wished him over to the record store, and we had a press conference, and so I got that. I did, like, the very first Europe concert in the States, too, during the final countdown. I was at, you know, woke up theater. I got a phone call. Bill, you got to be here. So, you know, there's so many things that we did. And Metal Rendezvous was a metal magazine. It was, just wasn't thrash. I mean, we gave the first press to, like, White Lion. I took the very first color photograph to be published of, like, L.A. Guns.
Nice.
The very first photograph in Kerrang of Metallica was mine. So there's somebody first that the magazine did. And it was cool to see Lars kind of like, you know, you see us once in a while, he like this little Lars stare, like, man, we finally gave what he wanted. But our thing was more, we were really global, right. And the whole metal scene in general. And we had to do thrash and the heavy metal stuff and the glam stuff all at one time. And
okay. Yeah, you were definitely at the right time and the right place for all that.
Yeah, which explains book number three, which is going to be like a heavy metal book with a, you know, and I was like, just being in San Francisco area and knowing how much stuff was started there kind of thing, it was really kind of cool. Like, Vinnie Moore, for instance, I was the only photographer to photograph Vinnie Moore in Vicious Rumors, you know, and stuff like that, you know. I remember when eBay would come through, he'd call the office, and if I was going to be there, he'd let no one else photograph him but me. And so,
nice.
That's interesting.
See, I told you there was a third book. Bill, what's the name of the book, the third one?
Oh, yeah.
Right now, it's tentatively called Power Surge. Actually, there's going to be five or six books.
And that's going to cover the gamut.
Yeah, the whole 80s.
And now it's time for the Gene Simmons Lyrical Screw-Up of the Week.
Oh, yeah! Yeah,
let me go! Listen to the Decibel Geek podcast on your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and WebOS phones with Stitcher. Stitcher's smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
All right, Chris, we're up to you and your pick. We're up to 1986 Megadeth, Peace Sells.
Peace Sells is a great album,
yeah.
And it's released on Capitol Records '86. This was when Megadeth, in my opinion, was really hitting its stride. They were starting to get a little bit more notoriety at that point. They opened for Alice Cooper on the Constrictor tour at that point. And the record is great, but I have to go with, which is the staple of all of us that grew up in the 80s, it was the intro to MTV News. It's the title track.
Yeah.
This is Peace Sells, But Who's Buying?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great tune. I love that one. Everybody knows that song. Peace sells, but who's buying? Bill, do you concur? Great song.
Actually, it's the very first heavy metal single or thrash single. I mean, you know, Dave had that brilliant stroke, and that was really before Metallica had any kind of, you know, singles in mind, whatever. Dave came out and beat him to the punch. So
I actually didn't know that. That's interesting.
That is really cool.
Well, yeah, because Metallica's first, you know, didn't have a really single until one.
Yeah, I guess that is true.
Yeah.
The whole won't make a video, and then all of a sudden here's one.
See?
Exactly. Yeah. And Dave, I think he had more of a, you know, savvy to do that. So he knew he had to do stuff like that. Because, you know, he's on Capitol. When I first saw that, they opened for Motorhead. And the long story, I won't get into it, but it was like I was so blown away by that. You know, the band had gelled so much, and they came on being so professional on a bigger stage than they ever played, kind of thing, and it just blew doors off. It was crazy.
Yeah, good times, good music back then. We're talking to Bill Hale today on the Decibel Geek podcast. Bill's come out with a ton of great books. He's got Metallica Club Days, you know, and this is a look inside the early, early days of Metallica. And, of course, Megadeth, his latest book, Another Time, A Different Place. You guys want to check that out.
I was going to ask you, now, these books focus on the earliest days of both bands. Now, was your relationship with these bands mostly in the early days, and did it get cut off at a point, or are you still in contact with these guys?
I was hanging out with Mega and Metallica until like 1999. I would see my gigs and stuff. I at 1989, I decided I needed to stop a little bit. Mm-hmm. I was every day, every other week, you know, flying around here and there, and it's cool and all, but you get to a point where you want to have a life, kind of thing. So I moved to LA, and I still worked in the business. I photographed bands still, but I wasn't like traveling nonstop anymore.
Right.
Then I moved back to the Bay Area, and I already saw Hammett. We saw a bunch of gigs together. Saw James at a couple of UFO concerts and stuff, and we still contact through buddies. I have, you know, buddies who are like, "Hey man, Les said hi," or "Hey man, James said hi," and with Dave, I've always kept in contact with Mustaine, you know, here and there kind of thing. And then we had two projects we both wanted to do back in 2000. It didn't work out. And then I get an email from him, I guess, just before he started his book. You know, he wanted some photographs for his book. And I ended up doing like 22 photographs for his book, which is kind of cool. And a lot of the early Metallica stuff are in, you know, his book. So
yeah, it's really
cool.
We still
talk here and there, you know, a lot of emails. And like, I have a lot of friends, and they always talk to these people for me. And I'm not super private, but I'm, you know, I'm kind of in my private phase. I'm raising kids and having some, you know, personal time right now. But I still work with bands.
Yeah.
There's bands that fly out here, or I have a weekly gig on Sunday with a guy named Henry Capono, and he's like this major Hawaiian superstar kind of thing. And you never know when the show plays when his gigs. I mean, like last week, Mick Fleetwood showed up. Eddie Vedder shows up, you know,
oh, cool.
You just know,
nice.
He's that kind of superstar. And a lot of people in the mainland haven't heard of him, but
right.
All the hip people have, so it's kind of cool.
That is awesome. I was going to
check that out.
I was going to ask you, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, since you were around these guys in the very earliest of days and you saw them before success hit and everything, what was your reaction to all of the therapy stuff in the Some Kind of Monster movie? What did you think when you watched all that?
Personally, I think that's Lars's way of keeping the band in the limelight. It was Lars's idea to do things, and you know, it was probably time to stop and reflect a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I didn't really get into all that. I thought it was kind of ironic, and he had to bring Dave Mustaine in it. And it's like, no matter what Lars does, Dave's someplace in his conscious. And so Mustaine's 40th birthday, he's driving up to San Francisco to talk to Lars, and they didn't tell Dave that it was going to be recorded kind of thing. And all of a sudden, Dave gets there. He's doing the outtakes, and Dave goes, "Well, it's his camera's here," you know. And it's like, but it's Lars's way of keeping the band in the limelight. And now, I guess the last 5-6 years, the band does itself now, finally. But it's always Lars trying to do something to keep the band, you know, when they cut their hair and did all that alternative stuff, that was Lars trying to, you know, keep the band valid.
Yeah.
I suppose you kind of look at it at that time, you know, how popular reality TV was and continues to be. You know, maybe that was Metallica's way of making their own reality show without actually having to shop it out to networks or not. They just put it out on DVD, you know.
Yeah,
it was the Metallica reality show.
Lars has been wanting the film kind of thing, too. So it's kind of one of the first forays into a movie kind of thing. So,
yeah.
But it's all Lars. I mean, he's amazing. You know, for a long time, people didn't really understand Lars. But I think now, in retrospect, I mean, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, all the stuff, their own festival, I think people will start really understanding what Lars is about. You know, he's not the typical drummer, that's for sure, right? I mean, there's tons of them go blow him away, but Lars always has this thing. He always has the right drum parts. He always has the great drum sounds. But he's not a drummer, really. He's a rock star. Hi, Lars.
Nice.
I'll get this email from somebody who in Lars Fringo, hey, man. You know, and it's funny because Lars and I had this relationship where I didn't for a long time want to deal with certain things, you know, because I didn't have to because, you know, as we all progressed, we all got famous or whatever, you know, and I'm on stage with Whitesnake, 75,000 people. I'm over here with Scorpions or whatever. And, you know, Lars and I had this kind of not relationship for a long time. And then all of a sudden, you know, I had to do books and I'm talking about Lars all the time. And, you know, I discovered or rediscovered who he is because he really is like this amazing rock and roll impresario or whatever, right?
Right.
I mean, he just knows what to do. And, you know.
All right, Bill, well, that brings it up to your turn to pick a song. We're having a good time playing DJ today. Bill, your turn. You're going to pick something off of Master of Puppets.
Master of Puppets, huh?
Yeah.
A Battery, right?
Yeah, why not? Battery's a rockin' tune, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, let's do Battery, Metallica, Master Puppets from 1986. We'll be right back. Man, that's a great tune. I love that one.
Oh, yeah. I never get tired of Battery.
A heavy rocking tune, man. Love it.
And we were talking about the Some Kind of Monster movie just a minute ago. And one of my favorite scenes from that, though, is when they're working out Robert Trujillo and trying to get him auditioned up and everything. And he suggested they play Battery. And they're like, you're going to play that with your fingers? And he's like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that guy is just an amazing bass player. When we did our top favorite bass players, Robert Trujillo was one of my very top picks.
Yeah, he's great. Bill, any thoughts on Robert Trujillo?
You know, he came in after, and so I think he's a great guy. I haven't met him, but what I've seen of him. What he did to Metallica, he brought this physical aspect to the band, which made James be more physical. I mean, you notice the early videos when Robert's in the band, you know, from 80, from 2008 and stuff. You watch, you know, everybody had to get in shape because Robert's in great shape. And Robert's younger than, kind of younger than these guys. And the interaction and what he does, he really makes James do a lot more work, which is kind of cool. Look at, because James really gone through a renaissance again. I think the whole band has, but James really has come to terms with who he is and what his past was and, you know, all that stuff. And he looks great. I mean, I always watch the YouTube clips of their meet and greets because it's just amazing how these fans from all around the world come up to James and they're like, you know, the typical thing, like, oh, I love you. You did this for me. You rescued me or whatever. And James takes it in so graciously, which is so cool. Because I remember the stories when he was a kid, he would write to Aerosmith or whatever, and they would never write back. And then, you know, 70s rock stars weren't this conducive or open, you know, and so and James really appreciates all this stuff, which is really kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. He seems to be, I'm not saying that Lars isn't fan friendly, but James almost has more of that one-on-one connection, and Lars almost, like you said, Lars is more of the rock star. James seems to be more of the guy that just wants to drink a beer and play guitar, you know.
Cliff really brought that to the band. Cliff really said, okay, this is our fans. These are our people. Cliff was the one who started all the fan interaction. And when he went away, and then Jason got a band, that was Jason's gig, before the show, after the show, meet and greet like that. And just later on, then they understood, because they all knew how big fans are, because you're nothing without the fans, right?
Right.
I mean, really, seriously, and they really understand this. And so, and now, you know, James is really, because before any Metallica gig, they had the meet and greet, the Metallica fan club. And everybody would take the time and autograph all the autographs and take the pictures of everybody, which is really kind of cool. Like I said, Aerosmith would never do that, you know.
Well, Bill, you know, you were there from the very beginning. Your books are evident of that. You know, and this is a story that's been told a million times. But I want to know, you know, because you were pretty, you know, in tight with both of these bands, Metallica and Megadeth. You know, I got to ask, how close were you to the situation when Dave Mustaine was fired from Metallica?
I don't think, and nobody knew it except for Lars. and then he latched on to James, to piecemeal it, because it was all of a sudden out of the blue. Like I said, we all drank, we all got in trouble. Lars got in trouble too, as much as Dave got in trouble. I think Lars saw the band slipping away a little bit. With Cliff in the band, all of a sudden you had these two monster players, and then he's just the drummer. And, you know, Cliff brings all his ideas, and Dave will play with him and stuff. But in retrospect, yeah, I saw Hammett hanging out a little bit too much kind of thing. But, you know, that's maybe in retrospect.
So I think like a political move, huh?
You know, at the gigs or whatever, is a photograph of me in the front row headbanging with Ron Quintana kind of thing. No one talked about it because it was one of those things where it was like they like to make this pact kind of thing. When it first happened, no one's supposed to talk about it. Dave's gone. Kurt's in. We don't talk about it. Okay, that's it. But later on in life, as, you know, all the secrets come out, James mentioned in an interview a couple years ago, like, yeah, we're listening to demo tapes, driving to New York, thinking about, we should get rid of Dave. You know, and that's all of a sudden, oh, they're thinking about it before this already, you know.
Yeah.
And so cause they played a gig in New York with Dave, and then they fired him like a day later or whatever.
Wow.
You know? It was a lost thing. You know, because I remember hanging out. Here's a story no one's heard yet. I was hanging out on the second show with Metallica. Montgomery's still in the band. Hi, Ron. and I'm sitting with Cliff, and everybody's kind of, you know, drinking or whatever. And Lars comes over and, like, don't tell Ron, we're getting rid of him. We'll get back to L.A. And I'm going, yeah, he's right there. What are you talking about? So just knowing that about Lars, you know, and it wasn't too far away. Besides, Lars' rock star is Ritchie Blackmore. What is Ritchie Blackmore done on his career, you know?
Yeah.
And so when you emulate your rock stars, it was easy to
Ritchie Blackmore, man, what happened with him? He's like doing Renaissance festival music and stuff now.
Yeah. But he's doing it amazing, though. I saw a clip the other day from the new DVD that's coming out, and he still has it. I mean, he's playing whatever, a lute or whatever, but he's like all over the place. I'm like, whoa. Okay.
No, but I want to hear the Deep Purple Rainbow stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. time for a wicked lute solo.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know how many times you guys see, Blackmore. I've seen him like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Uh-huh. And this man has those fingers still, and he's still doing this stuff, even though he's in Renaissance costume with his wife singing in front. But he just does it all with it's crazy.
Oh, I'm sure he still has it. I just wish he would use it for the rock.
Yeah, use it for rock.
Yeah. I think everybody in the rock world wants Richie to do some more rock right now. And I think Richie's kind of happy where he's at. I mean, I can't speak for him, but just through the press and what he's done and stuff. Yeah. And he's been doing it now for 10 years or whatever, right?
Yeah.
I saw the very last Rainbow Tour with Dougie White. And I saw in Richie's face that he was almost done with this. He's just going through the motions and he's at a small club. And, it's Blackmore playing a small club. So it's like, okay.
Here's what I like to listen to, and it's my final pick on the show tonight. We're having fun hanging out with Bill Hale. It's Down to Me. It's 1988, So Far, So Good, So What. I'm going with Hook in Mouth.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Axl Rose's Alarm Clock, and the reason the band is late tonight is because I'm busy listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
And a lot of people, you know, everybody talks about the Metallica stuff from the 80s, but man, Megadeth was right there on par with them.
Absolutely.
You know, I just, musically, they were always neck and neck, and sometimes Dave even won out, in my opinion.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I mean, it's hard to pick between two bands like that, Metallica and Megadeth. They're both so good. And that's what I like about today. We're focusing on the early stuff, which is by both bands, my favorite.
If I could add a little thing to it, it's always been two against one, right? It's always been Dave against Lars and James.
Yeah.
It's always been two against one, and you know, Dave's been neck and neck kind of thing. So it's kind of cool.
I thought it was Dave and Nick Menza against Lars and James, right?
Well, no, I mean, in the long run, because it was just it's Dave's band.
Oh yeah,
right.
Two against one.
I was gonna bring up, and not to be on a downer note, but you dedicated the new book to Gar Samuelson. What are your memories of Gar?
I think I wrote it, and he's like your cousin, the older cousin always gave you a wedgie. I wasn't ever too sure about him. He's always a nice guy, but yeah, I always had that little mistrust to him, that little deviant to him. And he was just good. And doing the book, the more I saw him, the more like, wow, he really, I don't know if he set the mold for anybody. I don't know how much influence he had. I know that lineup. The first one was still revered as this golden era, but he really anchored it and stuff. And just thinking about him, because what I have to do, I scan the negatives into my computer, do the Photoshop, so I see these images for like up to 6 hours a day. So all these things come, and just, it was Bar, man. And I've known him a long time. So he was a good guy.
That's awesome. And Dave wrote the foreword for the new book. And how did that process go about? Did he just send that to you, or did you actually get to have a good conversation with him about this?
We emailed back and forth because he needed, like I said, his book it was coming up and he needed photographs, and he knew I had all the photographs. Mm-hmm. And then I told him, only thing I'm going to do this if you do my forward. He said, fine.
Nice.
And then reading the forward, the first time, okay, that's cool. But then I read it again and I look at the photographs, and Dave, you look, every time I point a camera, he's looking at me like, what are you doing? He's had this, he's reluctantly letting me do my job. Uh-huh. And in the foreword, he says this, that he wished he would let more people have done that, because there's not very many photographs of him in his early days. It's just mine and, Harold's and Brian's. But it's tough when you're a kid, We're coming up and you have all these issues, you don't know how to deal with them. And photos photographers isn't his thing, so...
Well, yeah, can you imagine being a guy like, Dave Mustaine in those days, and they're, getting photographed by the same guys that are taking pictures of, like, Winger and Poison and bands like that, and they're saying, all right, Dave, now, you need to pout your lips a little bit more. Dave Mustaine's not going to do that,
No.
So I would imagine most photographers just didn't get them the way you were doing it, and the way you were doing it was just catching them naturally, and that's about the best way to do it, I would think.
Yeah,
so,
it's a trust factor. He knew me a long time. I'm a familiar face. He knew I wasn't doing anything silly. He knew that I was going to get photographs that rocked. And, and they turned out that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. Aaron mentions the whole wing, the same people shooting Winger and stuff. It was interesting to me that it was a photo of Dave Mustaine that was used on the cover of the Decline Part 2 movie. Because Megadeth was such a small part of that film, and 90% of that movie was about all the hair bands wearing the makeup and stuff. And it's just funny because if you looked at the cover of it, sight unseen, you would think, oh, this is a movie about thrash metal.
Yeah, you're right. I never really thought
and
about
it's
that.
Such,
but yeah.
It's such a small part of the film. But what was your reaction to that movie when it came out?
Kind of in shock and horror. I knew most everybody in the movie. I knew everybody. And like, the guy from Chris from Wasp is like, dude, what are you doing? And, Penelope caught these people at their worst, I think. I mean, the only person who came out really was Gene Simmons, came out amazing, right?
Yeah, he was
Paul Stanley, iffy, and Ozzy, buffoon, sorry, Oz. But, he's making breakfast, cracking eggs, the eggs are going on the stove and stuff. And it's like, and Lemmy even, she got Lemmy at a bad time. It's like, we all know alcohol is a disease. It doesn't come on because you're on the road and there's a bottle of whiskey there. You're either going to drink it or not, And he kind of tended to that, that's why I'm an alcoholic, because, the bottles are there. But, You know, and the worst one was Chris. I felt bad for him. It was like, I felt really bad for him.
Yeah.
You know, the scene in the pool, Danny, Vodka and his mom there just shaking his head.
Right.
And all the other kids, I mean, I knew most of those guys because I, you know, I photographed the LA scene too. And it was like, God, you guys.
See, it's interesting hearing somebody that knew the people, because I watched it as like a 12-year-old kid, you know, thinking, in Nashville, Tennessee, going, wow, it's crazy out there in Los Angeles and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, when you're 12, you buy into all the stuff. And of course, I'm thinking, you know, Paul Stanley really does have, you know, four chicks in his bed every night, and he really does sleep in his costume that he wears on stage, you know? So it's like, it's interesting when the perspective changes as you get older, and then, realizing, man, Ozzy looks like Shelley Winters in that movie, you know? It's bizarre.
Well, it's the old perception is reality, and it's purest.
And then if you know Penelope, right, she did Winged World. You're thinking, you know, not too far off the mark.
Yeah, they're both comedies.
Yeah, pretty much.
The very first Decline was like hardcore LA punk. It was totally different. And there's a third movie no one's ever seen. And so,
Really?
Yeah, there is. There's a third.
Yeah.
Well, there's a one.
Yeah.
He did one on
the. If I know it's out there.
Yeah, I think it's about like the new metal stuff that's out now.
Something like that.
Like
no wonder I haven't seen it.
Well, yeah. But, all right. Well, Bill, I want to thank you for coming on with us. And best place to get the books would be Amazon. Would you say so?
Yeah, but Amazon, they have great discounts. Actually, Walmart has it for $1 cheaper. But Amazon, you know, they have the great shipping. You can buy a bunch of books and give you free shipping and stuff. Amazon's kind of cool, man.
And I'm looking at I'm looking at the page right now for the Megadeth Another Time, A Different Place book, and it's kind of funny because it's got the discounted price listed from $19.95 down to $13.29, and then it says you save $6.66.
Nice. Bill, did you plan that out? You planned it that way, didn't you?
Just the publisher and Amazon. I have to say that and do a screenshot. That's crazy.
I'll do a screenshot of it. Doesn't get any more metal when you go shopping than that, folks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Save yourself $6.66. That's wild. And, of course, Metallica Club Days, 82 to 84, Bill's book. You know, if you are a Metallica fan, if you are a true Metallica fan, this book is pretty much a must-have for you. You know, it's a lot of pictures that you've never seen anywhere else before. You know, it's an insight into the early days of Metallica in the band's infancy. You know, and it's an amazing book. You got to have it.
And you can't have one without the other, so go ahead and buy both.
Exactly. Yeah, and save yourself some money on shipping.
All right, well, thanks. Perfect. Thanks so much for coming on, and we will definitely want to have you back on the show again in the future if you're up for it.
Thank you, Bill.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. Thanks, guys. It was great, man. It was cool. I had a lot of fun.
Remember to check us out at dbgeekshow.blogspot.com, facebook.com/decibelgeek, and Twitter at decibelgeekpod. Also available for free on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.